On the wall of the Special Forces Memorial Court at Fort Bragg, the words of the prophet Isaiah are etched in stone. I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send and who will go for us?" Master Sergeant Gary Gordon and Sergeant First Class Randall Sugar answered that call. Today we inscribe their lives and their deeds in the distinguished and valorous history of this country's men and women in uniform. We pray that God will embrace their souls, and may their service and sacrifice inspire generations to come. Master Sergeant Gary Gordon and Sergeant First Class Randall Schugert were real American heroes. During the military operation in Mogadishu on October 3rd, two American helicopters were downed by hostile fire. Although United States Army Rangers established a defensive perimeter around the first downed helicopter, they could not reach the second one quickly by land. In the wreckage of this helicopter lay four injured Army crewmen. Another helicopter with Sergeants Gordon and Schugert on board was dispatched to provide cover from above, but they came under withering fire, and the two sergeants instinctively understood that if the downed crew was to stand a chance of survival, someone would have to get them on the ground. Immediately, Sergeants Gordon and Schugert volunteered to go. They were told, "No, it's too dangerous." They volunteered again. Again, they were told, "No." They volunteered a third time, and permission finally was granted. Sergeants Gordon and Schugert knew their own chances of survival were extremely bleak. The pilot of their helicopter said that anyone in their right mind would never have gone in. But they insisted on it because they were comrades in danger, because they believed passionately in the creed that says, "I will not fail those with whom I serve." And so they asked their pilot to hover just above the ground, and they jumped into the ferocious firefight. The citations that will be read shortly describe the extraordinary courage that Sergeants Gordon and Schugert demonstrated in the battle that followed. Gary Gordon and Randall Schugert died in the most courageous and selfless way any human being can act. They risked their lives without hesitation. They gave their lives to save others. Their actions were clearly above and beyond the call of duty. Today, on behalf of the United States Congress, I award them both the Medal of Honor.
By direction of the President, authorized by Act of Congress, March 3, 1863, the Medal of Honor, for conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity at the risk of life above and beyond the call of duty, is awarded in the name of Congress to Master Sergeant Gary I. Gordon, United States Army. Master Sergeant Gary I. Gordon, United States Army, distinguished himself by actions above and beyond the call of duty on 3 October 1993 while serving as sniper team member, United States Army Special Operations Command with Task Force Ranger in Mogadishu, Somalia. Master Sergeant Gordon's sniper team provided precision fires from the lead helicopter during an assault and at two helicopter crash sites while subjected to intense automatic weapons and rocket-propelled grenade fires. When Master Sergeant Gordon learned that ground forces were not immediately available to secure the second crash site, he and another sniper unhesitatingly volunteered to be inserted to protect the four critically wounded personnel, despite being well aware of the growing number of enemy personnel closing in on the site. After his third request to be inserted, Master Sergeant Gordon received permission to perform his volunteer mission when debris and enemy ground fires at the site caused him to abort the first attempt. Master Sergeant Gordon was inserted 100 meters south of the crash site. Equipped with only his sniper rifle and a pistol, Master Sergeant Gordon and his fellow sniper, while under intense small arms fire from the enemy, fought their way through a dense maze of shanties and shacks to reach the critically injured crew members. Master Sergeant Gordon immediately pulled the pilot and the other crew members from the aircraft, establishing a perimeter which placed him and his fellow sniper in the most vulnerable position. Master Sergeant Gordon used his long-range rifle and sidearm to kill an undetermined number of attackers until he depleted his ammunition. Master Sergeant Gordon then went back to the wreckage, recovering some of the crew's weapons and ammunition. Despite the fact that he was critically low on ammunition, he provided some of it to the dazed pilot and then radioed for help. Master Sergeant Gordon continued to travel the perimeter, protecting the downed crew. After his team member was fatally wounded and his own rifle ammunition exhausted, Master Sergeant Gordon returned to the wreckage, recovering a rifle with the last five rounds of ammunition, and gave it to the pilot with the words, "Good luck." Then, armed only with his pistol, Master Sergeant Gordon continued to fight until he was fatally wounded. His actions saved the pilot's life. Master Sergeant Gordon's extraordinary heroism and devotion to duty were in keeping with the highest standards of military service and reflect great credit on him, his unit, and the United States Army.
Welcome to the Global Recon Podcast. I'm your host, John Hendricks. I'm on with my co-host and creator of the Veterans Project, Tim Kozak. And we have a special guest on with us today, Bob Keller of Gamut Resolutions. Gentlemen, how's it going?
What's going on, John?
Hey, John. Thanks for having me on as a co-host again. It's always a privilege and very happy to have you on, Bob. Thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, you got it.
All right, so Bob was on previously. I want to say
it was a while ago.
Yeah, it was a while. It was like over a year, definitely over a year.
Yeah.
So since it's been, you know, a while, I would like to have Bob kind of reintroduce himself. So for the new listeners, you guys can get familiar with him. So Bob, you can talk about, you know, what you were doing before you joined the Army. And then we could kind of, as much detail as possible, walk through your career.
Going back before. So I went in the military late, so I did a lot of things before. that could be a whole podcast in itself. right before I went in, I was actually playing golf for a living.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So...
John hears me getting excited over here. I'm like, tell us about your life before.
There's a big difference from going to that than going right into the military. But yeah. Once I got in, so for those that didn't hear the last podcast, I have 21 years in now, and all those have been with the special ops community.
Can we go down that rabbit trail a little bit, John? I guess if you don't mind, I wanted to kind of ask you a little bit about, you know, that life previous. So what built up into you joining the military in the first place?
I think it was just always in me to do that. But I think just the how I was raised, what I was doing at the time, I thought that was the route I should go. Is, you know, trying the golf route. And I want to say that was going to be the easy way to make money, but that's kind of what drove me to that. I mean, my whole life growing up as a kid, the only thing I did, I lived in the woods. I mean, that's all cripes I had in my backyard, you know, we had 5 acres, but backed up to hundreds of acres. I had obstacle courses back there. I had forts everywhere. I mean, I lived out in the woods. That was like my passion, running around, acting like Rambo. So yeah, fast forwarding, you know, my whole life and starting doing the golf thing, traveling around, I knew it wasn't I wasn't doing it because I loved it. I was doing it because I thought I could make money at it. And that finally hit me at a tournament in Louisiana. I missed the cut, and I was like, what the hell am I doing? And, you know, what do I really want to do? And shit, I packed up my car, drove back to Florida, and like 2 weeks later, I was in the military.
So, Bob, would you say that you felt pretty fulfilled, even, you know, despite missing that cut? I know you missed that cut in Louisiana, but did you feel pretty fulfilled playing the game of golf? Were you happy in your life at the time playing the game?
I was happy. I was having a good time. It was just, it wasn't what I love to do. I wasn't passionate about it, you know? I mean, it was a job. So, yeah, I was having a good time, but I knew there was other things I wanted to do, and the military was one of them. So that's what drove me to that, and yeah, I wasn't going to go, or I didn't want to go into the military and just do anything. I went in with a Ranger contract right off the bat, and then just kind of kept progressing from there.
And what year was that you joined?
97.
Oh, okay. So this is pre-9/11. So you were.
That kind of brings me to what I was going to say just for my intro, really, is what was the decision to start my shooting business. And it really was because I had pre-9/11 service and I had post-9/11 service. And right. the difference between training from pre-9/11 to post-9/11 was just huge. So when I started my business, that was the biggest part, is kind of stepping away. I would say where I come from, you kind of live in a bubble where you don't really see how the civilians and everyone else are training and what they're doing on the range. So when I finally saw that, and like same thing with like the social media, you know, all the videos out there and all the crazy stuff being taught, when I actually started watching some of that and seeing people on the range training the wrong way, that really drove me to want to get into the instruction so I could give back a lot of the stuff that I had learned from pre-9/11 to post-9/11. So
that's what drove me. I imagine you're coming from the pinnacle of training. I imagine there was some crazy stuff that you were seeing, you know, from the shooting community. You know, how much did that, you know, drive you to teach the proper way? And obviously there are differences in teachings and the way that it's done, but I'm sure you saw some crazy stuff going into opening your and starting your business.
Yeah. I mean, that was the whole reason why I did it. I knew that I could give a lot back to the community just from the stuff that I had seen and I had done. Because it's all really basic stuff that matters. And I think what happened throughout the years, especially with the instruction, because, you know, I mean, there's so many instructors out there now. It's really comes down to, I think, a lot of instructors, they're doing the right thing. They want to do the right thing, but it's how can you fill a class, or how can you actually get students to leave and be happy for what they did for that 1 or 2 days, you know, and that's right. Making up, I don't want to say bullshit, but it kind of is. It's, you know, doing crazy drills, making the students happy, making them feel like they're getting that Hollywood or, you know, the movie training. Right. And that's not what works in the real world or in real gunfights. So yeah, that was the biggest reason why I got into instruction and started my business. And I haven't changed from that. I mean, I started out teaching real basic stuff, trying to focus and stay on just shooting. And I haven't, that hasn't changed in the last 2.5 years.
Can you talk a little bit about the fulfillment from, you know, seeing it click in a civilian to where, you know, you're going from, you know, basically I'm sure you're dealing with some people that have almost no knowledge or you have to kind of reteach their whole, you know, everything that they know. How much fulfillment is there in seeing them finally catch in that moment and realizing and some of those things starting to click?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, that's why I'm still doing it. It really is cool to see people that come to my classes think either they think they're good shooters and they think they're doing the right thing, or people that have no clue. And then to watch them progress over a day or 2 days, or, you know, depending on a 3 day, 5 day class, whatever it is. And then to leave going, you know, holy crap, that's everything, or that's a lot of stuff that I didn't think actually mattered, which really comes down to all the basics of shooting and safety. Safety is one of the biggest thing that people, you're shooting guns that freaking kill people and people are not safe on the range, or even guys that actually live by the gun just have been taught or done the wrong thing when it comes to safety for so many years that that's just something they're not thinking about. So that's one of those things. I think that it should be totally opposite, but the more experience you have and the more gunfights you're in, the more safety conscious you are. Whereas you would think the brand new beginners that don't know what they're doing, you'd think they would be like terrified and nothing but safe. And then you'd think all the guys with experience should be like, you know, this is my safety, you know, going back to that Black Hawk movie. Yeah. Black Hawk movie. It's totally opposite. Yeah. I mean, we are safety Nazis, or at least I am, just because the more shit that you see and the weird things that happen in a gunfight, you know that you can't not be safe, because bad things happen. You know, when people are getting blown up, they're getting shot. If that gun's not on safe, your finger's not up the trigger. That's how freaking other accidents happen when they shouldn't. So, right. And guys that don't know that and haven't experienced that, they don't think it's ever going to happen to them. So yeah, it should be totally opposite, but it's not. So I think that's the biggest thing. I mean, not only, you know, getting the guys out shooting and telling them or teaching them the why of what I'm doing. The greatest thing that I see when guys leave the range is that they're freaking safe. And that's the one thing I'll tell people and everyone that's listening now, like before I start a class. I mean, obviously when you come to one of my classes, I want you to become a faster, more accurate shooter. But ultimately what I want you to do to leave that range in 2 days or after 3 days of training is become a smarter shooter, a safer shooter, and a more confident shooter.
Right.
That's what matters in gunfights. And no one ever thinks of that stuff. So that's what I'm looking for. That's what I want people to get out of my classes.
Hey, John, John, do you like to shoot, John?
Oh, I love it.
Yeah,
man, John said he was going to come to one of my classes. It's been a year.
John, you haven't gone to his class?
Not yet, man, unfortunately.
John's terrible, man. John has made so many promises.
Yeah, I never keep him. I'm horrible, man.
All right, I'll offer it up to you then. You can come to one of my classes.
Well, unlike John, I'll actually fulfill my promise.
I would love to have you.
Oh, I love it, man. Hey, John. So, John, you like to shoot, right? One thing, you know, it's amazing to me how many people, when I joined the Army, even had never been around a weapon before in their life. It was amazing to me. Like when I was joining at 17 years old, you know, my father kind of, I wasn't raised on a range or anything, but I remember very, you know, learning from our, my aunt and uncles, actually their pastor at their church, he was an old naval officer. And I just remember them like slamming gun safety into me. Like there's a laser that extends from the barrel and goes all the way around the world. And if you flash somebody at that laser, you killed them, you know? So anything that you never put, you know, you never put anybody or, you know, anything that you don't intend to kill or harm, you never put that in front of the barrel. As simple as that. Yeah, it was, you know, I learned that when I was 6 years old. That was the first time my dad let me handle a weapon. Like, he had me, you know, out. He obviously had his arms around me, you know, was teaching me proper procedure. But, you know, as a young kid, I was learning that. So it was amazing to me when I was getting to the Army, John, and I was seeing all these guys and, like, I mean, you know, flash each other with their muzzles, like, not just totally, yeah, like, having no clue. I think I saw a drill sergeant on like 10 occasions have to like butt stroke somebody or like, you know, like knock them off the range or something. Just ridiculous. Where you're like, oh man, we got a long way to go, guys. We're fighting the global war on terror with these guys.
Yeah, I see it every day on the range, and that's what I'm trying to change, because it is absolutely a must.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think some of that also depends on, like, you know, where people come from, because
right,
you know, if you're raised in a certain, like, you know, I'm from New York City, and I think, you know, it's mostly like a liberal city. You know, there are conservatives, yeah, here and pro-gun people and stuff like that, but I think, you know, if you're not conscious of it, you grow up in a place like New York, inner city, or, you know, maybe Chicago, something like that, where you grow up and guns are only used, the only time you hear about guns are when they're used in a crime or something like that, to kill somebody or, you know, robbery or something like that. So you kind of associate it with as being something negative. But
right,
then you go somewhere else, like, you know, somewhere in Texas or North Carolina, and that's like kind of like a way of life or a culture, and it's used as a tool, you know, for protection or for hunting or, you know, whatever people are using it for. And yeah, I think it's just a different approach. And I think, you know, when you come from a place like New York City, you kind of have to be exposed to something different in order to view it differently. And unfortunately, not everybody has that kind of experience, you know?
Right. And just to reiterate that, I mean, I grew up in suburban San Antonio, and, you know, even though it's not like, you know, I'm not out in a rural area, it's still Texas and it's still Military City, USA. So you just grow up around, and your neighbor's got a weapon, and your neighbor's neighbor has a weapon, your neighbor's grandma has a weapon. Like, you know, it's just kind of a constant, and not everybody's out shooting all the time, but it's just kind of accepted as everyone has one, you know? Like, I always tell people, like, the worst place to like rob a house would be Texas. Like, it's just, yeah, a generally bad idea, because yeah, you're automatically getting into a bad situation. You know, it's like, hey, honey, you know, somebody came in the house, you know, target practice, you know? So, you know, it's like, right, there's that kind of culture, you know, here in that, even in the suburban and city areas, you know, it's kind of just accepted as part of Texan culture.
Yep.
Yeah. And I think, and then obviously, you know, with the experience that, you know, Bob has and you have, Tim, you see different things with people being exposed to the weapons and still having that, you know, like Bob said, not so safe, like, tendencies. And I think there was a video that surfaced like 2 or 3 days ago of like a federal agent. The guy did like a backflip in a nightclub. Drops his weapon, and then as he's picking it up, it discharges and he shoots the guy in the leg. It's like, holy shit, you know.
Yeah, I saw that.
This guy's a federal agent, you know.
Oh, I know. That was pretty bad.
yeah.
Bob, I gotta ask you, when you know, trying to change that mindset, you know, when you got guys out on the range, and, you know, and obviously I don't want to give all your, you know, instruction away because people, you know, need to go to your class. But what, you know, how do you change the mindset of somebody coming into that kind of environment where maybe they haven't learned the safest practices, you know, as far as, you know, gun handling?
Yeah, well, just repetition. It's not that they don't want to be safe. I mean, there's some drills that you do, like guys that actually are good shooters, but don't do everything, you know, the safest way, or putting the gun on safe before doing things. That's really just showing them that you can, if you practice it enough, you're not actually wasting time by being safe. That's just explaining it and telling them the why. But all the other stuff, and guys that just don't know. It's not that they don't. It's not that they don't want to be safe. They just didn't realize. Like dealing with ARs, most people, once they load up that gun and start shooting, that gun stays on fire the whole time. And shit, half the time, their fingers stay on the trigger. So
right.
It's getting them out of the habit of doing that and showing them that they can be just as fast and be safe. And then once they realize that and they learn how to do it, it's just repetition. It's getting out of that bad habit, getting them to make being safe a good habit and for it to happen without even thinking. So, you know, that's hard to do in a 2-day class. I mean, that's something that when they leave one of my classes, I mean, you got to keep that up. You got to keep doing it throughout the rest of your shooting career, you know? I mean, and right. Just like I said at the beginning, it comes down to repetition. Muscle memory.
Right. And, you know, with the philosophy that you have, you know, when you're approaching this, I've seen other videos that you've done online and we've talked before, and it seems that you like to push and focus on the basics and kind of mastering the basics. And you feel like in your experience that mastering the basics really is what works in like a real gunfight type of situation, right?
Yeah, it's everything. And the reason why is, you know, I don't want to call out any other instructors, and this doesn't even have to be at a class. When guys go to the range just to practice on their own, if they are on an outdoor range and they're, you know, able to do like the run-in gun and stuff and the quote unquote cool guy stuff, you know, and that equates into like scenario based training where they're coming up with drills, trying to create scenarios that it would be in a gunfight. The reason why I don't do that a lot is that I couldn't put a class through a million freaking scenarios, have them know that those million scenarios and have them down pat, and they're ready to be in a gunfight. And then when they get in a gunfight, even though they went through a million scenarios, I guarantee at that time of the gunfight, it won't be one of those scenarios that we went over. It's always going to change. You can't train for scenarios. But yeah. The one thing that does stay constant in a gunfight is you bringing the gun up, you getting sight picture, and you pulling the trigger. That never goes away. So, yeah. You know, you do have to be physical. You have to be an athlete to be a good gunfighter. But you can do that at a freaking CrossFit gym. You can do that on your own, being in shape. Then when it comes down after, you know, once you have that, you are an athlete. You're physically fit. You can handle yourself in any situation. Well, then it comes down to the shooting. So, depending on the situation, which I said, it's always going to be different. I mean, every gunfight that I was in, you know, I'd almost laugh to myself and say, holy shit, I never fucking trained for this one. But the one thing, the one constant that never changed was me having to get the gun up, me having to pull the trigger, or me getting sight picture, me pulling the trigger. That never changed. So that's why I do what I do and I teach, because I can't put you through enough scenarios to get you prepared for a gunfight, but I can teach you how to shoot. So that's the only thing that matters. I mean, I'm not saying doing the running, gunning, and doing the scenario-based training isn't good. I mean, that is good to, it'll bring out your faults. So if you start, and I do the running and gunning and the running drills and moving in different barriers, I do that, but only after I've taught something on the flat range from a static position. And then I will incorporate all those drills that I just taught into a drill, like a running drill. And that will bring out all the deficiencies that we just did on the flat range static position without moving and without thinking about anything else. And it just shows people like, holy crap, all that stuff that I was doing from a static position, when I didn't have to think of other things, I was doing perfect. And now I added one simple, you know, moving from one position to another, and all the stuff that they were doing perfect on the flat range went to shit. And it shows the guys like, okay, I got to go back to the flat range, perfect what I was doing, make it an absolute muscle memory to where that'll happen without me thinking about it. And then you can start doing more of the running and gunning stuff. But, I'm talking about guys that are doing well in the flat range. They're doing everything right. I get them on the clock, which, you know, gets the heart rate up right off the bat. Have them, you know, running from position to position. I mean, you have guys all the time that forget to put the gun on fire. You know? that can't happen in a gunfight.
Nope.
So it just shows them. So it is good to do running and gunning drills or scenario-based, but it's after you have perfected the shooting portion. And not many people do that. You know, and I would have been one of them. That's where that whole pre-9/11 to post-9/11 thing comes into play. I was one of those guys too, and it was pre-9/11. You only know what you know, so you're trying to come up with scenarios or training that you think it's going to be like in a gunfight. You know, so, and that was all getting the heart rate up, doing the Wazoo PT stuff on the range, you know, climbing over walls, climbing under cars, doing whatever. That was like my daily training on the range. And then you go to, you know, post 9/11, you actually see what actually works over there. And shoot, all that stuff that I did pre 9/11, I probably only do 10% of the time. The rest of the time, that 90% of the time when I'm on the range, it's doing freaking shooting from a static position. So that's where it's different.
So you went into the Ranger Regiment off the bat pre 9/11. Were you still in the Ranger Regiment when the wars kicked off?
Nope. I'd gotten out and actually got out and went to college.
Okay.
So then when 9/11 kicked off, I was still in college, and that's what got me to go back in, because that was what I always wanted to do, was go to combat.
Was there kind of a bit of a, I guess, you get out, so you know you're in Ranger Regiment and you're there, and we're not really actively involved in any conflicts at the time. Did you get in and just feel almost disillusioned in a way because there was nothing going on? Did you feel, or you just, you know, thinking to yourself, I joined to go to war and we're not at war? And was that your reason for leaving?
Yeah, well, I mean, I kind of had a plan going in. Get my degree, and then, you know, either do a federal job or what have you. I really didn't have, you know, either go Secret Service or FBI or something like that. But I knew I needed my 4-year degree to do anything federal, so that was the reason why I got out right out of the Ranger Battalion. And that was the reason. There was nothing going on. I went in. I wanted to have that experience. Obviously, I wanted to get in gunfights and be in combat. That's all that I ever wanted to do when I was a kid. So when there was nothing going on, yep, it was like, all right, let's go do my, you know, get the college done, do that. And then, of course, I got out, and like a year and a half later, 9/11 kicked off. So that's why I went back in.
Gotcha.
And did you go right back in, or did you finish with your school?
Nope, didn't finish. Still haven't.
You mean it's hard to be special operations and finish your degree at the same time?
Yeah. Well, a lot of guys do it, so you know, good on
that's
them.
Amazing, man. I don't know how I was distracted enough by a regular career by being deployed. I was like, guys were taking like mobile classes and online classes, and I was like, no, I'll just get back to it when I get out of Iraq.
It's impressive, the guys that do it, especially the ones that have families.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the biggest. Besides, like, the charity stuff I do, well, for the special ops, but for the law enforcement too, the biggest thing is the families are the ones that struggle. I mean, you're right. Talking, there's a lot of time gone, you know?
Right.
Oh, yeah.
So that's a big, big thing. I mean, I got fortunate enough. My wife said, you know, She had enough, and that was all I needed to hear. So, yeah. But, yeah, it's a, like you said, hard to do both. There is no time. I mean, so guys that do it, it's impressive, because I never went back. I haven't got mine.
Right.
As in a degree, that is.
Yeah. So, you know, so you were, we talked about how you were in before 9/11 and after, and the difference in some of the training. And do you feel like guys went to war and immediately realized what training was happening up to that point wasn't effective, or was it, you know, when you came back, you kind of look back and go over, you know, things that happened? Can we talk about kind of that whole process? Or
yeah, well, I wouldn't say it was ineffective. I just do what I do is because when you have, like I said, all that stuff is still good. Like how we trained before, it still worked, and it obviously, you know, it helped me. I mean, I didn't die.
Yeah.
But the reason why, like I said, the constant, the thing that never changes, you know, getting the gun up, getting sight fixed, pulling the trigger. Since that is the constant, and not many people have perfected that yet, I only have 1 or 2 days or 3 days on the range with you. So if I'm doing nothing but drills for 2 days, you're not getting the shooting that you need. You know, so I don't want to say we were training the wrong way, but it was we were wasting a lot of time on the range setting up drills and running drills when we could have been shooting. And you know, that could be totally different for other guys too. I mean, that's what I saw, and that was the big takeaway for me with all the gunfights that I had been in, was when I was thinking about how to set up my training. I was like, what is the most important thing that I can teach in 2 days or in a day class?
Right.
And every scenario I came up with for, you know, my curriculum was, it always came back to shooting. That's the only thing that mattered. I mean, obviously if I have a month with you, we would get into a lot of other things besides just shooting. But when I only have one or two days with you, that's what I want to focus on, because I know that's what guys need.
Right. And so with your company, you know, you're running these shooting courses, but you also do a lot of work with law enforcement. Can we talk about some of that?
Heck yeah. Yeah. It's probably 50% of who I work with. And it's awesome to be able to give back to those guys, because they are guys that are living by the gun. I mean, they're carrying a gun around every day. They need to be properly trained. So, yeah, I do a lot of work with law enforcement, and that's why I started my charity called the Gamut Initiative, which part of that, the Gamut Initiative, is Operation Blues that I do, and that's giving free training back to the law enforcement.
Okay, and so, how does that work?
So I mean, it's 100% free training for those guys. So it's kind of a no-brainer. And the problem is that a lot of the departments don't even have the budget to send their guys to free training, even if I'm coming to them, wow, like to have, wow, enough ammo to take the classes.
Wow.
Or, jeez, you know, or they're not going to give the guys time on the clock to go to the classes. So then it's got to be like a weekend class. And then, you know, then the guys come into the situation of, you know, it's either work or family, you know. So it's amazing how many times, like, guys will reach out or teams will reach out to do an Operation Blue and end up not doing it because they either couldn't get the time off or didn't have the ammo. So,
wow,
that's where the whole Gamut Initiative came in, though. To start the charity where people can give to the Gamut Initiative. That money goes through the Sarasota Community Foundation. So you get the pot of money in there, which is all tax deductible. It's 501c3. And that way, if a department wants to do an Operation Blue, we take that money from the Sarasota Community Foundation, and that's where you can pay for the range, pay for the ammo. All they have to do is, you know, have the time to be able to go to the range. And then twofold on the Gamut Initiative. Nice thing about that is that we're helping out the military veterans too on the special operations side, because now that money that's in the pot not only pays for the ammo and the range for the cops, but it also pays for guys that are like transitioning out into the real world from the military, that I can send them to go teach a class and pay them through the Gammon Initiative. Wow. So you're giving guys that, you know, veterans that are getting out that don't have a, you know, solid job lined up, and they're kind of in that transition period between finding a job, to go, you know, do a weekend or a couple weekends giving classes.
That's awesome. I remember when we last spoke, I think it was at the time, it was just mostly you doing the teaching for the classes.
Yeah, that's why I started the Gammon Initiative. I mean, and that's my problem with the Operation Blue. I mean, I'm pretty busy doing the civilian side and, you know, the paid LE classes, to where I can only do a certain amount of Operation Blues a year. So that's kind of where the Gammon Initiative came in. I was like, you know, if I could get guys to donate to the Gammon Initiative that want to help the LE out, I can, if, you know, down the road, if this gets big, hopefully, you know, people will donate after hearing this.
Yeah, give up your money.
You know, you could do 30, 40 Operation Blues a year.
Right.
You know, throughout the country, given free training. I just don't, me personally, I don't have the time because of, you know, my company and all the classes I already have set up. So, yeah, if we could get other instructors to go out and give these classes, we could do a hell of a lot more Operation Blues and give a hell of a lot more LE guys free training.
Right. And I think that's like a common issue for police departments across the country, or sheriff departments, is the budgets are not federal, and it really depends on the municipality that they're in. And some departments have much bigger budgets than others. And
absolutely,
you know, like the NYPD, they have, like, you know, humongous budget, and they're able to get guys good training and stuff like that. And but then if you go to some small town in the Midwest, maybe it's not the same deal, you know?
Yep, absolutely. Run into that all the time.
Yeah, is there, let me ask that question, Bob. Is there a difference, you know, obviously between departments as far as what you see from individual officers when they come into the classes and their knowledge and, you know, around a range and how much, you know, and how much this training comes into an issue?
Yeah, big time. I mean, they need help, you know, and it's might be some of their faults to not do it on their own, but you're talking a lot of departments. It does come down to leadership. So some departments do have the budget, but they have the wrong leadership. Like the leadership, they don't want to pay for equipment. They don't want to pay for guns. They don't want to pay for ammo. They don't want to pay for training. So, you see that a lot too. Departments that do have the money, but they don't have the leadership that backs the training. And then you see the opposite too. Good leadership, not the biggest budget, but they're all about getting their guys trained properly. I mean, you're talking about some of these departments, and this is, so I deal with a lot of the SWAT teams more than I do, you know, the local beat cops.
Right.
But some of these departments, they're shooting 50 rounds a year. That's like crazy. Their annual call is 50 or 40 rounds, whatever, 50. And that's all that they're getting. Now, that does come into play, like, you know, the laziness of humans. You know, I mean, if it's spend the weekend with your family or go spend your own money to go shoot, you know, me personally, I mean, if I was carrying a gun every day on the street, I would be spending my own money if I wasn't getting it from the department. But a lot of guys, they don't have the time. If they can't do it on duty time and they have to spend their own money, well, they decide to spend the time with their family. And I would never freaking judge anyone for that. But that's where the Operation Blue comes in. After I saw that and heard, not only, and I don't want to say, you know, the lack of skill, but I would say the lack of training. I couldn't believe that's all that they were getting. Right. You know, so that was the whole reason why I started the Operation Blue. Like, all right,
I mean, that's disturbing to hear that. Sorry, Bob. Yeah. That's disturbing to hear that number. I mean, you know, you're talking about 50 rounds. I can't even imagine a scenario, you know, and it's no wonder, you know, you got 18, 19-year-old kids making huge choices as soldiers or Marines, you know, going into rooms, you know, where you got 0.4 seconds to make a decision, you know, which is about the equivalent of hitting a 95-mile-an-hour fastball, you know. You're going into these rooms and you're making these huge decisions as a young kid. I mean, the training, you know, it has to be top of the line. So these departments, you know, and I understand the budgetary issues, but when you have the money and under leadership, and leadership is not training those officers right, that is a disgusting misallocation of resources.
And you know, you got to look at it from the leadership point of view too, or when it, I mean, it is straight up comes down to money. I mean, you got to think of how many law enforcement officers are out there. You know, if they were letting them, or if they were doing 5 or 6 classes a year to get these guys, that wouldn't even be enough to properly train them, but at least it'd be something. I mean, you're talking a ton of money just on range time and ammunition. So, you know, I get it. And that's why I did the Operation Blue. Like, how can we get them free training where they don't have to spend for ammo, or they don't have to spend the money on ammo, they don't have to spend the money on the instruction? Because otherwise they don't. It's very expensive.
Right.
When you're talking about all of the LE in the United States, I mean, it's a huge number. So
yeah.
But yeah, something does have to be done, because it's not enough, you know, to get what they're getting at the academy and then only get once a year. It's you know, and that's really just to get their qual. Now, some departments are different, but I would say the majority, that's it. It's not enough.
I would go as far as to say is, you know, some of the issues that have taken place, you know, throughout the country over the years between law enforcement and civilians in cases where, cause you know, there's shootings and things like that. And I think if you pay too much attention to the media, it kind of drive you crazy. Being either anti-cop or pro-cop. But yeah. I think if you look at, you know, reality, most interactions that police officers have with civilians end up being okay. And I think the media kind of sensationalizes some of the bad interactions. And but I do think that in some cases, you know, had some of these officers had a little more time to train and stuff like that, some of those bad interactions might have ended a little differently, you know.
I mean, I can't speak for Bob, but just, you know, just knowing the difference in training and like things becoming instinctual, things even as simple as, you know, running with my team and doing mag drills all the time, you know, just things where it becomes reflexive. You know, I watch a lot of these videos, and I can't speak for each individual officer because I don't know what's going on inside of their head, John. But I can't speak for Bob on this either. But oftentimes as I watch these videos and I kind of play them back again and again, I watch it and I think that's fear. That's nervousness. There are nerves there, and that there's no place for that. And it's understandable to go like into a situation fear, but it's what you do with that fear, you know, that handles that moment. And when it's instinct, you know, it doesn't really allow for that time to kick into where you're feeling that fear or those nerves. And Bob can speak to that more than I can, but I just know that the things that, when they became more instinctual, it was easier for me to pull that trigger because it was instinctual.
Yeah. Well, and that's when it comes down to shooting. I was going to say before you said that, I mean, just the situations that end up bad that didn't need to be, like what you said, you know, might not be the right word, but you know, the fear there, that's where, when it comes to my classes, like I was saying, I want you to come out of my class being more confident, like knowing you know how to handle that gun and knowing that what you're going to shoot at, you're going to hit, you know, and you're going to be able to do it fast and accurate. That comes down to that confidence thing. Well, you're going to be less likely to draw or to pull the trigger if you are confident that you're going to win. I agree. I think the lack of training and not knowing that you can actually properly handle that gun, you know, fast and accurate, is it does come into play. So right.
Bob, I wanted to, since we're kind of talking about, you know, that mental aspect, as far as, and I guess it comes down to being confident and remaining calm, and in your experience in the military and going overseas into combat, have you seen instances where guys have lost their cool and it turned into a bad situation?
No, me personally, I haven't seen that. I'm sure that has been the case. I think that goes down to everywhere I've worked, you know, we are trained to a higher standard. Like, so we have that confidence, you know,
isn't that amazing though, John? And that's, you know, sorry to interrupt, Bob, but that's amazing to hear. That shows you the high standard of training there, John. You know, where guys are going into the scenarios and there, and Bob can say personally that he's never seen that. I mean, right. That's pretty incredible.
But I think that is, I mean, not only just being the best at what you're doing, but it comes down to knowing that you can do it. It's that confidence.
Right.
And I think the big thing too, and I said it last time we were, cause I think we covered mindset, last time. And you know, that's 30 or 40 minutes of talking anyhow, but like the one thing that I'll tell people, like if to kind of prepare yourself better, if you're carrying the gun every day, if you're a concealed carry guy or law enforcement, I mean, you have to start thinking. Two things I say is you need to, every day you walk out that door and you're carrying, you have to expect a bad thing's going to happen, and you have to accept the fact that a bad thing could happen. And if you think that daily, when that bad thing actually happens and you're expecting it and you're accepting it, it's not going to be as stressful of a situation. The guys that walk out the door with a gun strapped to them and they don't, you know, they're scared of something happening, what do you think is going to happen when they get in a situation? You mentally have to be prepared to expect it and to accept it.
You know, going to that mental side, it kind of reminds me almost, and this is obviously a more extreme scenario, but it reminds me of when, you know, John, I've talked to you very often about my World War II guys and some of these guys going through the Battle of the Bulge and Iwo Jima and things like that. But, you know, these guys, I remember some of these guys having like letters, you know, already written out to their family, like talking about their
right.
And like how they just wanted their family to go forward and stuff. And I said, you know, well, what was the greatest, you know, sense of fear that you had? And some of them will even tell me that, hey, I wasn't really that afraid. It was just the fact, like, in my head, I was already gone. I was already dead in my head. Like, right. I had already experienced the worst possibility in my head. So there was nothing the enemy could do to me. And I think that, like, kind of mental training, I know that's a much more extreme kind of mental, you know, vision of, you know, what could happen. But I think that kind of speaks to the powerful side of that mentality and just understanding that there is a possibility of something going wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, some of that mental stuff really is what separates, you know, the good reaction and the bad reaction. And you know, I see it all the time. Like, you know, I take the subway here in New York daily, and you know, in New York City, if you ride the subway as much as I do, you'll see, I would say every time I get on the subway, I see someone who has some kind of like mental health issue. You know, a guy gets on the train, he's talking to himself, or a guy gets on the train, he's yelling at the top of his lungs, or, you know, that kind of thing. And the amount of people that, you know, I notice this as, you know, I'm sitting down, I'm looking around, the amount of people who are not prepared for something to happen, like they're just not paying attention to anything. It's really astounding. So I remember one time, this guy got on the train and he had like, I wasn't sure what it was. He had something in his hand. And at the time, it was in the papers, you know, there was like this guy was going around like cutting people on the train. So I'm looking at him and he's kind of pacing back and forth and he looks like he has like kind of violent energy, I want to say, if that makes any sense. And so I'm like, I'm not going to take my eye off this guy until he gets off the train or until I get off the train. And
right.
He's standing next to people who are just like, you know, looking down, reading a book or something like that. And I'm like, if this dude decides to just lose his mind for a second, he's going to cut someone and they're going to have no way to react or, you know, they're going to get cut and then freeze and, you know, maybe even get killed. And it's just amazing how much people don't seem to have that. Yeah, they just don't even pay attention. Like that person, like.
No situational awareness.
Oh, forget about it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny that you speak to that, John, because I noticed the same thing when I was in New York. There were several times where I noticed guys with the kind of that, you know, same kind of violent energy. And you know, I was just watching them the whole time. Like, I had my eyes on them, and I'm looking at people, and they're just on their phones. And I get it. Like, you're in the scenario all the time. But you know, you're in the scenario all the time. And you can never lose that situational awareness, especially in a 3D battlefield in the world that we live in, where terrorism or the possibility of things happening and going wrong is a constant. You know,
you never know.
Yeah. What were you say, Bob?
No, I said you never know.
You never know. It's that situational awareness and that idea that, hey, man, you know, technically no place is really safe. You know, it's not going around or fear mongering or anything like that. It's just having to do with the fact that, yes, I do know my exits. Yes, I do know where I'm seated at in a building and how quickly I can get out, those kinds of things. And then monitoring a situation where it's like you said, somebody's walking around like that. Yeah. My eyes aren't coming off that guy.
Yeah.
I'm thinking it's going to go wrong. You
see that maniac look in his eyes. You're like, you know what? I'm not going to take my eye off you.
Yeah. How do you train that, Bobby? You know, somebody, because that's kind of built in, you know, and John's speaking about it from, you know, John didn't serve in the military, but obviously he has a situational awareness. He's kind of trained himself that way. How do you train people for that? You talk about, you know, the basic training of, you know, of understanding the weapon and doing some of the basic drills, but how do you train for that? And do you train for that kind of situational awareness?
Well, you could train them, you know, you could give classes on what you just said, you know, knowing your exits and always be looking for the way out or what you would do. But I mean, really it's just getting guys, whoever's listening to this podcast, it's getting them to think, you know, I mean, they're doing the right thing by listening to the podcast,
right.
You know, watching videos or going to classes. I mean, it's, you just have to be aware. I mean, again, that goes into the whole scenario base. You know, you could give a class on, well, what happens if someone comes in this door and does this, and this. Well, you could tell someone 1,000 different scenarios of that guy coming through the front door, and when it happened, it would be totally different than what you trained him on. But right. just being aware and actually watching and you know, paying attention to things, that's what you need to be, so at least you can react and you can see it happening instead of just like what John was saying, guys just on the subway either ignoring it or pretending it's not happening. Well, that's those, if something does bad happen, they're not going to see it initiate, and how are they going to react to that?
Right.
So, I mean, it's staying aware and always paying attention, especially if it's someone that is acting freaking crazy or funny.
Yeah. Right. I see it every single day, man. Like,
yeah. I mean, make a mental note of that. All right. Watch this guy and see what he does, see where he goes. And then always, you know, pay attention to what he's doing.
Right.
But I mean, you can't. It'd be hard to go. Yeah. I could give a class. Anyone could give a class on, you know, what happens if the guy's in the subway and does this, and this. Well, that's awesome to think about, but I guarantee when it happens, it's going to be totally different than what you were trained on. I mean, it's just being able to react, and kind of what you were saying with the CQB, Tim, like making that decision in freaking, you know, a nanosecond.
Right.
That's life. And you have to be prepared to do that in any situation.
Yeah, 100%.
Right. So, Bob, if, you know, anyone listening to the podcast, any law enforcement guys are interested in reaching out to you or linking up, where's the best place they can do that at?
Yeah, so everything's on my website. So the best thing, like to check schedules and, you know, emails and phone numbers to contact me, gamutresolutions.com. And anyone out there that would like to donate to the Gamut Initiative, that is thegamutinitiative.org.
And okay, and the Gamut, you're spelling that as G-A-M-U-T?
Yep. Yep, right, and then also I do post all my course schedules every once in a while on IG, and that's Keller Gamut Resolutions.
On Instagram.
Correct.
All right, cool. So, Bob, it was great talking to you and having you back on. I know it's been a while, but
yeah, I know
it. Yeah. Yeah, Bob, thanks a lot for coming on. It was a real privilege and honor to speak with you. I know that, you know, this kind of perspective, it's needed to be shared by more society and just staying knowledgeable in every scenario. You know, I hear about it a lot, obviously being around the Veterans Project all the time, being around different veterans and special operations. They're always constantly talking about awareness and how, you know, people need to be ready, and you can't rely on, you know, law enforcement to take care of your problems for you all the time. You know, you got to be able to self-sustain and take care of, you know, a problem if it comes. So it's really refreshing to have more people out there serving the public. So I appreciate that.
You're very welcome. And for both of you guys, like I said, if you ever want to hit up one of my classes, check out the schedule as well.
Yeah, I'm sorry that John hasn't taken you up on that yet, by the way. I apologize for him. I just like to tease John. It's just fun. So anytime we can point something out, you know.
John, I'm a nice guy on the range, so don't be scared.
John's just nervous he's going to get in there with a special operations veteran, and he's, you know, you're going to be screaming at him. And
I definitely don't do that.
and I also wanted to ask, Bob, so you don't just do training in a one, like, centralized location. Like, you're moving around to do training as well.
Yeah, I'm all over the country. I try to space out the open enrollment ones as good as possible. But I do, a lot of the classes are just guys contacting me wanting to get a group together. So it's, you know, they host the class. So depending on anywhere in the country they want it, they can host the class. You know, they set up the range, get the guys, and then I come out to them. So that's really a good route to go, because then that you're shooting with guys that, you know, everyone knows each other. So,
right.
Yep. That's definitely I would say the 50% that I, of civilians that I do, 50% of those are hosted classes by guys just wanting to set up their own group class. So that is definitely a possibility.
Awesome. All right. So again, Bob, you know, thank you for doing this. You know, we appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Yeah, and thank you for your service as well.
Well, you're welcome.